This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from the Mayor's Office of East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Thanks to Katara Williams, Dr. Williams, and Clay Young. They did fine work in my absence the last 2 days. I was at a radio conference in beautiful Park City, Utah, but it's good to be back home and start with a person who is a bright light in journalism and has been for a few decades, Michelle Singletary, the personal finance columnist for the Washington Post. She's a graduate of the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins University, and she has done great work in her career and often comes up with things not only about the economy, but about economy and culture. And one of those areas where the two dovetail is in tipping. And in one of her recent works, which got much attention from readers of the Washington Post, has tipping gone too far? Good morning, Michelle Singletary.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is an honor to share the microphone with you. And I know our listeners have read your work many years in the newspaper of record here, the Baton Rouge Advocate, and we might talk a bit about the economy, and tipping is often affected by the economy. But you say Americans may have tipping fatigue, 1 in 3 adults calling the practice out of control. Why is that the case?
Well, you know, the pandemic hit, lots of businesses had to shut down, you know, in service, you know, seating people in the restaurant. And so they went to takeout, and part of takeout, you know, they were putting tip machines and asking people for tips. And so lots of places are still dealing with inflation. And as a result, a lot of servers, more services than we're used to, are asking for tips. And I think there is a lot of tip fatigue because of that.
877-217-5757. We'll take a few calls in our time with Michelle Singletary. Now, you were saying particularly for takeout. Now, I don't take out much, but when I do, I tip. I just don't tip as much. Obviously, if you're at a table for an hour or two, you're taking up time. And so if I'm there 2 hours, I tip way over 20%. No, maybe some might say not say way over, but it's much more than 20%. But nonetheless, do we have certain etiquette that we should follow?
Well, you know, it's so interesting because I wrote about that in my column that appeared in the Washington Post, and that part just outraged so many people. Oh, I'm not going to tip if they're just handing me my food. And I agree with you. That's my philosophy. It's just that when I'm there at the counter and I'm looking at the workers, many of them, sometimes young, they're probably working their way through college or, you know, trying to make a decent living. And I'm standing at the counter, I'm thinking, you know, is a couple of bucks really going to set me back so much that I can't be generous? And that's what I'm trying to encourage people. Things have changed. You know, we went through this horrible thing, the pandemic. You know, lots of people lost their job, and even those who came back, you know, maybe a lot of customers haven't come back. And so I don't begrudge people saying, hey, listen, I'm working behind the counter. I know it's not a sit down, but it's up to you. And you know, when you talk to the servers and the owners, there's no hard feelings if you don't tip at the counter. But my goodness, shouldn't we be looking for reasons to tip it and not to tip and just be as generous as we can afford to be? And that's how I feel it. So I'm at the counter. I'm tipping. I'm picking up my ice cream. I see a little chip jar. If I get change, I'll put it in there. And I just feel like those workers are working hard. They're up on their feet. They're not making a whole bunch of money. And if I can help them out, then I'm going to do it.
Now, a listener notes, this is Holly in the Garden District, and I've done this too, is that when you're assessed an automatic percentage, sometimes I don't even notice that and end up tipping on top of the tip. Now, some people say that's not fair pool, but that is not an uncommon thing today, is it?
It is not. Lots of restaurants, especially when they're large parties, have an automatic 18 or sometimes 20% tip. And you understand that, you know, they want to be sure that the server is compensated because you know, that's the system right now, that tips make up part of their salary. And so sometimes you'll see places in hotels and otherwise. And so I just encourage people to just look at the bill, question if there's a service charge. And that's what I do. If there's a service charge, I want to make sure that the server, or the person who's serving me, gets the tip or gets part of the service charge. So I'll ask them, do you get tips from this? And obviously that will lead me to know whether or not I need to tip even more than what the service charge is. And if it's already built in there, oftentimes I would tell you about 95% of the services, oh, you don't need to tip me anymore. It's in the service charge. And I appreciate that honesty to them. And sometimes I, when they say that, you know what, I'll go ahead and tip someone on top of the tip. I mean, I just think to whom much is given, much is required. And if you can afford it, why not be generous?
Well, this national survey that Michelle cites, YouGov survey of 1,000 American adults, an astounding 51% said it was acceptable to leave no tip after receiving bad service, but even with good service. Amazingly, in 2021, 75% of those at a sit-down restaurant who say they go there tip, meaning 25% don't. And 65% in 2023. It's gone down by 10%, meaning one out of three people don't tip at all. And these waiters and waitresses, they often have to tip the bus boys and bus girls. And so they go in the hole when somebody doesn't tip. I'm amazed at that number, Michelle.
I was amazed as well. And here's the other thing, and you might get a lot of calls because I got a lot of pushback on this as well, that we need to stop saying if the service isn't up to my standard, I'm not going to tip. And so I said, bad service or not, you still should tip because that's part of the salary. That's part of the cost of eating out. And people are like, oh, you know, if it's bad, I'm not tipping at all. And I'm thinking, hey, it's very subjective about the service. Now, if it's truly bad, then you should talk to the manager and you should figure out, you know, talk to the manager to see what has happened, and say, hey, listen, I didn't get my meal. My meal came cold. I want to be sure to leave a tip, but I want you to be aware that there's something has broken down in the service. And we also know from surveys that a lot of the subjective tipping, quote unquote, bad tipping has a lot to do whether the person is a woman or a minority. And there's a lot of other factors that come into play. Maybe there was a woman and the guy didn't think that she was nice enough to him. Or, you know, maybe you wanted five cubes of ice and you only got two. So you're going to, you know, skip tipping. And so if we remove that idea that we shouldn't tip if they're bad service, then it gives you grace to give people a chance. You know what? They had a bad day, or maybe they had to come to work and had childcare issues and they're a little flummoxed. And so they're not on their game. Imagine if our salaries were docked every time we had a bad day on our job.
877-217-5757. Please be concise in your remarks to the remarkable Michelle Singletary, who's been doing her thing as the columnist of note, the financial columnist for the Washington Post. Let's go to Jim on airline. Jim, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, folks. As a former server and bartender, I've dealt with the tipping thing a lot in my life. I do have a problem with what we do here in the United States, which we allow businesses to base their labor costs on their customers paying for their employees' salary, essentially. And we truly do need to move to the European format and actually pay servers an actual real wage. And you don't really do the tipping.
All right. Jim is right. Thank you, Jim, as he often is. In Europe, they don't do it the way we do it. And some people believe they've got a better mousetrap, Michelle.
You know, this is an argument that people say all the time, and don't get me wrong, the system that we have now is not fair, because people probably don't aware that there is sort of a tip minimum wage. So the federal minimum wage for tipping is $2.13 per hour. If the service tips when added to wages don't add up to the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25, then the employer must make up the difference. And so that's where it is. So that system is not fair. We should be paying people a living wage so that they are not subjected to the whims of customers. Mm-hmm. The so-and-so establishments service get quite a bit in tips because it's a high-end restaurant. The customers are tend to be, you know, well off, and so they tip well. But in other situations, perhaps they're in an area where the people aren't as wealthy, the tips may be extremely low. And so that's where the inequity comes. And so the caller is absolutely right. A better system would eliminate all the subjectivity of whether it was bad service or, you know, whatever. But we aren't there yet. And so my argument is because we don't have that system in place, we should not punish servers. We should advocate with our legislators, both in state and federal, to have a federal living wage. And then all of this does go away.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Michelle Singletary of The Washington Post after this 89.3 second timeout. 3, 2, 1. This is Jim Inkster, and we're back, and it's nice to be with you after a few days off. And again, thanks to Katera and Clay for their fine work, and we're blessed to have Michelle Singletary in the house for a few more minutes. She is a columnist of note. She follows personal finance like nobody else and is a national treasure at the Washington Post. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're talking about tipping, and her column has received much attention, and I'm amazed in 2023, as of last year, only 65% of the people who go to a restaurant tip their servers. Only 53% tip their barbers and hairstylists. Go on from there. Only 40% tip their Uber driver. My goodness. And hotel housekeepers. Only 23% leave a tip after being in a room for 2 or 3 days. And you really ought to tip every day. Coffee shop baristas, 22%. It's not really a pretty picture, but some people have what Michelle has termed tip fatigue, and I can understand that too, but it's better to leave something than nothing at all. 877-217-5757. Randy and Zachary, please be brief. You're on with Michelle.
Well, off the subject there, Jim, but on this date, 95 years ago.
All right, what's your question? I don't want that. I want your question about this, okay? Well, let's move on to Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on with Michelle. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. My question is this. There's some advice out there that says that it's a really good idea to use cash and keep cash floating around in our economy, that it keeps its value and it moves along and people can use it. Also, it's been quite a while since the American worker has gotten a raise. We could all use a raise. So anyway,
that's been $7.25 since the Obama years, the minimum wage. And a listener notes and corrected me in my open. I said it was $2.30 was the wage for waiters and waitresses and servers at restaurants. It's $2.13. Michelle was right. But what about cash versus tipping on a credit card? Does that help the server, Michelle?
You know, what I sometimes do is I ask the server, do you prefer that I leave your tip in cash or do you prefer to leave it on a credit card? Most of the time, since I'm out and about in many places now, only take credit or some sort of plastic so that you don't have a choice. But I've done both. You know, I don't want to get into people's tax situation because sometimes servers and some people who I'm not going to say are trying to skirt Uncle Sam, but they might prefer cash because they may not, you know, be reporting all the tips. I hope that's not you, right? There is a lot of reasons why you should be including all of your income and tips, not of which because it's illegal not to, but also when you report your information to the IRS and Social Security, that helps your Social Security benefits at the end of the day. So I just sometimes and just ask the server, but if I've got cash, I put cash on the table. If I've got my pay by card, obviously I put it on the card.
And a listener asks, this is Tracy at the Capitol, when did we go from what was considered appropriate at 15% for a tip to 20%? That happened somewhere along the way, and now if you don't tip 20, you're you're basically not doing what you should, according to some.
You know, here's the thing, folks, and I really do mean this. Money has a lot to do with where you are and your emotions. And when people ask that question, I sort of think, well, you know what? Hasn't your salary increased over the years? And so the tip percentage has increased along with everything else. It costs more when you add in inflation to live, to buy food, to send your kids to college. And so when we're begrudging that 5% difference, or, you know, even if it's 25%, I have a little tip app on my phone, and I'll start at 15 just to see what it is, and then I'll move it up to 18 and 20%, and the difference is just some dollars. And I say to myself, because I get tip fatigue too. I come from a low wage background. So I factor all that in. And at the end of the day, I have been so blessed with a wonderful career, great husband and family. And I look at that difference, and it could be $5 or $6 or $2. Mm-hmm. And I think that could help someone put gas in their car. It could help them. That $2 could buy a loaf of bread, or well, maybe not a loaf of bread these days, but, you know, a dozen of eggs. And then I say to myself, can I afford this? I'm out eating, so I can. And if this is going to help that person, I'm going to give that extra 20% and not grouse about that gratuity. And I would ask that you do the same. Should the system be fair? Yeah, but let's work on that on a legislative, but on a personal level, just look at that dollar's difference. And if it's not going to send you into some sort of, you know, financial shock in your own budget, why don't you just go ahead and be generous?
All right. Well, Tom on Blue Bonnet says he's intimidated by a tipping jar. When you have a tipping jar right there when you're paying for your coffee or whatever it is, some people don't like that a lot.
You know what? We all groan. If you don't like it, don't tip. it's just a jar, people. For goodness sakes, in this country, we're living in one of the richest countries in the world, and we begrudge low-wage workers those few pennies or dollars. I would say question yourself. And I say this, and I know I get people who push back on this, but those few dollars is really going to take you over in terms of your budget, but perhaps you should be at home cooking for yourself.
Jeffrey Scanlon writes, people do not realize that servers work for the customer, not for the restaurant owner. If we eliminated the tipping system, as they do in Europe, then restaurants would have to charge a lot more money to customers in order to pay servers decent wages if servers are making all their money from the restaurant. Then, he says, they're not going to care very much about taking care of the customer in their experience. Is there some validity to that, or is that overblown?
I actually think that is overblown. There are a lot of industries where people are servers and are not relying on tips, and the service can be great or it can be bad. I don't think that we should say that if they get a regular fair wage salary, that somehow they're not going to be serving us at the level that we deserve as customers. I don't think that that's true. I've met a lot of people in the service industry who that is their gifting, their God gift to serve others and serve quite well. So I don't buy into that at all. I think what will probably happen is everyone says, well, they should just increase the cost of the meal. But are you really going to still go? Because if you're going to still go, then you still shouldn't be grousing about the tip, because it's going to be the same, right? It's just going to be put in a different category. And so I just think, just question yourself, why are you grousing? And how are you voting? Are you voting for people who believe in a fair living minimum wage for folks? Because if you're not, then you should really be quiet, because you're not really walking the walk that you're fussing about.
Lindsay McDougall writes, I've always thought that if I didn't want to spend the money for a proper tip, then I should just eat at home. A tip brightens up a person's day in that line of work. It makes a difference for them. Final call for Michelle Singletary today, Patricia in Magnolia Woods. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. During the pandemic, I know that people in the restaurant and hotel industries were really hit hard. And so during recovery, I was trying to tip more. I was wondering if you know whether those industries or the people that work there have recovered from the pandemic, or if it's still struggling.
All right.
That's such a great question, and that tells me that this person has really been very thoughtful about what's happening. They are still struggling. We knew that, you know, just a couple of years ago, inflation was 9% plus, right? It has been coming down, but if you've gone to the grocery store, you paid anything, you know prices are still high. And think about that. During that, you know, two-year period, really 2 or 3 year period, people lost wages. So they're still making up for that. So if they weren't earning the same, right, that means they weren't able to save the same. And so now, yeah, I believe we still err on the side of being generous because we're helping other people continue to lift themselves up.
Well, Michelle Singletary, it's been a delight, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. We only got about 20 seconds, but is the economy going to be the big issue for the election that's 146 days away, or is that going to be superseded by other things?
You know, I think the economy will still be central, but I would ask people to look at the numbers and not the emotion of the elections, because the economy is actually doing really well. We just had the inflation figures. Our inflation has come down tremendously, and businesses are high.
Okay, we do have to roll. 3.4%, by the way, the inflation right now. Thank you, Michelle. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing the Robin and Renee team, and we had Michelle Singletary a few minutes ago, and now we've got Molly Sullivan. So the initials are MS for today. And these are two special people. And Molly Sullivan has been one of the most special people in my life. And I did not know her until 20 years ago today. And we met in the most unusual way. And she's been on this show once before, and it was on the 10th anniversary of June 12th, 2004. And on that date, yours truly almost perished in a car accident in Assumption Parish, Napoleonville, near the Donaldsonville and the Sunshine Bridge. But without the benevolence of Molly Sullivan, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair because it was a close call. And that's why I want to salute the person who saved my life on 12 June 2004. And good morning to you, Molly Sullivan.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Might want to get a little bit closer.
Is this better?
That's a little better.
All right.
So Molly was a truck driver, and she's done a lot of things in her life. And on that date 20 years ago, I was 46 and she was 43. I'd become station manager at WRKF in October of 2003. And the show started shortly thereafter. And then suddenly that Monday, June 14th, I wasn't here. I was in the hospital, as I was for 40 days, and it was a long recovery from a lot of injuries, including a broken neck. But the broken neck, ironically, isn't what almost killed me on that day. I was bleeding out from a car accident, and Molly was the witness who saw what happened, and she was the person who called for help. Otherwise, with minutes, if not seconds, being of the essence, I would not have made it. And Molly, you saw it. Obviously, I saw part of it, but you saw more than I did. What happened?
They had a white Chevrolet pickup truck that was in front of me, and he went around the vehicle that was in front of him and cut you off.
Got in my lane, right?
Yes.
Coming right at me.
Coming right at you. Head-on collision. Had you not swerved, but you overcorrected and lost control.
And I went off the road, then back on the road, and went into the other lane of traffic, and then boom, what happened?
The pickup that you had hit head on, they pulled over, you hit them, and they all were fine, but you weren't.
Well, they had some injuries too, but they weren't life-threatening. And
no.
To show you how violent a collision it was, they broke legs and things like that, which are serious injuries, but not life-threatening. But their vehicle was a Tundra, and mine was a Miata. And obviously, I had decelerated some, and they were going at a much faster pace. So it's amazing, just based on the laws of physics, that I didn't get killed. But my car was a mess, and so was I, wasn't I?
Yes, you were.
So what happened when you saw this?
I proceeded to try to catch the person that had caused the accident, and I turned around and went back, and you weren't conscious. So I cut the top of your car so that I could get you air and was able to talk to you until the paramedics had gotten there.
I became conscious. You gave me air first. Otherwise, I would have suffocated.
Correct.
And what was that conversation like?
I was just talking to you, trying to get you to stay alert until someone had gotten there. I had asked you who you were, and we just conversated until someone got there.
But you knew it was a serious
situation. Yes, I kept telling the people on the phone that you were going to pass if someone didn't hurry up and get there.
Well, I lost 7 units of blood, and last week we lost Richard Zuschlag, and I've credited Acadian Ambulance because they airlifted me to Our Lady of the Lake, and I had a bunch of doctors working on me, and I'm thankful to them for what they did to save my life. And I have some bumps and bruises to show for what happened on that day, but it's been a remarkable recovery and the goodwill of the people of Baton Rouge. We get criticized for a lot of things, but that was evident because there were people I didn't know who were coming to the hospital to wish me well, and I appreciated that. I was in that room for 40 days and getting stir crazy, but it was all done because of this lady, Molly Sullivan, and I lost 7 units of blood before they got me to the hospital. My friend Victor Saxe said I was as white as a sheet of paper when he came and thought, of course, that it was going to be the end, but it wasn't. And Molly, I first of all, want to thank you again for what you've done, because without you, I wouldn't be here.
I just thank the Lord above that I was there in order to be able to help. And I would wish and pray that someone would do that for myself or my children.
Mm-hmm. Now, listener Diana asked, did they ever catch the people who did this or caused the accident? No. But you tried. You tried tracking them down, but they got away. And as I recall, and of course, memories sometimes are faint after something like this, but there was one guy who did the same thing the guy you saw, and I got out of the way. And then the second guy, that was a closer call, and instead of going down into a cane field, I came back up on the road, and my car was spinning, and I went in the other lane, and boom, I get hit. And the great irony of this is that because I had a collision in the other lane, the accident was my fault because I shouldn't have been in that lane. But fortunately, the settlement in the accident, they settled for the limits of my insurance policy, which I appreciated. And I didn't get any big benefit out of this at all, other than a lot of doctor's bills. But I did get the benefit of a lot of meeting a lot of great people and appreciating the kindness of others. And most importantly, you.
I did nothing, no more than what I would hope someone else would do.
Well, I think the fact that you were a truck driver for 12 years probably gave you some insight into how many people, for example, would be carrying around box cutters.
I carry one in the console of my car just in case I need it to cut the seat belt loose or whatever.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, you're on Talk Louisiana. I think I know who this is. Rabbi Barry turned out to be my spiritual advisor. And he was at the hospital just about every day. God bless you, Barry Weinstein.
You bet. I'm so glad that you are okay. And I give thanks for your continuing healing. And I praise God that you are with us.
Well, you made it possible as well, because you gave me inspiration and you were my spiritual advisor. When I was brought in, they sent ironically, I was in a Catholic hospital, and I'm a Catholic, but they sent me a Protestant minister, and he said, "Where are you?" I guess trying to determine if I really was there, at least mentally, and I said, "I'm in purgatory," and he goes, "There is no purgatory," and I said, "Get out of here."
Well, you got the Protestant.
But I got Rabbi Barry. Rabbi Barry prayed over my near-dead body, and God bless you. And I remember one day he came and played the piano in my room, too.
So, that's right. I had a wonderful, wonderful time with you, and I give thanks to God that you are still the voice of Louisiana.
Well, thank you, Barry. I love you. And Barry had a close call himself on the 13th day of May 2016. Yours was as close as mine in a different way. He had an aortic aneurysm and got rushed to the same hospital. And it helps when you're close to the hospital, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. And it helps when you're closer to God, like you and I and all of our listeners. Praise God.
Well, thank you, Barry. I love you. Thank you. And best
love
to you
too.
And Linda and your family.
Thank you, Ruth
Laney, a great journalist who listens to this show. She says, happy for you, Jim, that Molly was there that day and her box cutter. And because I probably would have suffocated, number one. And then secondly, if you hadn't gotten the paramedics there, I would have bled to death. And I do remember them saying, Baton Rouge or New Orleans, we got to get you somewhere fast. And I said, let's go to Baton Rouge.
Right.
And they said, boys, we're going to Baton Rouge. But it took, what, about a half hour?
Yes. Yes.
For them to get there.
Right.
And those moments were precious. And with a broken vertebrae, the C2, the Christopher Reeve vertebrae, if I had stood up, I would have died too. I would have just fallen over and that would have been it. But were you holding me down at all? Was I trying to get out?
No. I kept telling you to just lay still, that help was coming. And you would go in and out, but you were able to talk to me whenever you were able to compensate. I would tell you, Jim, just lay still. It's going to be okay. Help is coming.
And I made a great friend that day, and I owe my life and good fortune to Molly Sullivan.
You owe me nothing.
Well, in some ways, maybe, but in other ways, I owe you everything. And it's impossible to repay somebody who saved your life. I remember my friend Lester Duhay once said, did you send her a ham? I mean, what can you do? What can you do? But this is one great lady and a person who would probably never be on a show like this if not for what happened. And I think once every 10 years, I should salute you, and hopefully we'll be around another 10. I see you've got some kind of a brace on your arm right now, so you have got some bumps and bruises.
Yes, just a few.
Well, we wish you a swift recovery, and what a gallant lady. And again, this shows what happened to me, the listeners, the people who didn't know me, and those who did, and we had an A-team of people at the hospital. And it was Steve Myers and Ann Edelman and Brian Calvert and his wife Marion and Victor Saxe and Esther Saxe, and they got me back to where I could function. And Mark Calvert of Southside Gardens gave me a place to stay. I had that halo on my head for 95 days. I couldn't get in a car, so I was able to stay at Southside Gardens and walk to work at WRKF. But thank you again, Molly. Take care and keep going. And we're back after this. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. I have a text message from Renee in Port Allen. So glad you're still here today. Thanks to Molly and to God. And Renee was married to my dear friend Mike Dana. At the time, she was not married to him, but in 2004, when the accident happened, Mike Dana, who as we know, for over 20 years was the public relations director at the Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation. He was at the hospital every day, as were several other members of our coffee group, and Darren Mann, Julie Baxter Pear, and many others. And I hate to mention people because I inevitably leave people out, but Mike was there, and the great irony of life is that he was full of vim and vigor and pumped me up, and then in 2015, 11 years later, he died much too young with esophageal cancer. And we all have a shelf life, and sometimes we defy the odds. But ultimately, as Dale Brown said the other day to Adam Walton when his father, Bill Walton, died, this is a journey we all must take. So be thankful to the higher power for every day, and take advantage of it as much as we can, and know that at some point, as I'm going to quote my friend Neil Gladner, who said of Rush Limbaugh, who once said he had talent on loan for God. Well, in February of 2021, that loan came due. 877-217-5757. Eric Weiner is with us. Eric Weiner is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Geography of Bliss and The Geography of Genius. And he has profiled a man who is instrumental in the formation of our country, Ben Franklin. The book is Ben and Me in Search of a Founder's Formula and a Long and Useful Life. Ben Franklin lingers in our lives, in our imaginations. One of only two non-presidents to appear on U.S. currency, he was a founder, statesman, scientist, inventor, diplomat, publisher, humorist, and philosopher. He believed in the American experiment, but Ben Franklin's greatest experiment was Ben Franklin. Eric, others have captured him, including Walter Isaacson, but you've done a magnificent job, and I don't think we should ever forget what Ben Franklin meant to our country and how his philosophy of life resonates today as much as it ever has.
Exactly, Jim. And that's what I've attempted to do in my book, and to set it apart from other works on Franklin, is to make it more personal. It's me encountering Franklin, not writing about him, but having a relationship with him. And I'm looking for the lessons that we could take away for not the 18th century, but the 21st century. And the man is as relevant today as he was in his time.
The book is Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Now when I was in kindergarten, I heard about early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. There was a bit more to Ben Franklin than that, but you know what? That's not a bad philosophy of life, is it?
Right. So that little line that many of us remember is from his almanac, Poor Richard's Almanac, which he published every year for a long time, and which contained these pithy sayings. And that's what he's remembered for, sort of condensing these complex ideas to simple formulations, like early to bed, early to rise. And they have the benefit of being true. Now, there was, as you said, much more to Franklin than that. He was a complex person, and I would say that if there's a word that defined him, it was usefulness. That was his goal in life. Happiness, yes, but above happiness was usefulness. The man wanted to be useful to others, and he was. He was through his inventions, the lightning rod, the flexible catheter, believe it or not, the Franklin stove, all kinds of things. And he was useful as what today we'd call a social entrepreneur, starting the first circulating library in the U.S., in Philadelphia, the first hospital in the U.S., also in Philadelphia. And don't forget, he was a diplomat, too. I would argue that after George Washington, he was the key figure in winning the Revolutionary War.
You note that Ben Franklin and Philadelphia are conjoined as inseparably as cheese and steak, but you say that wasn't always the case.
No, and a lot of people think that Franklin was born in Philadelphia. He was not. He was born in Boston, Puritan Boston, and he did okay there, but it was not the place for him. It was not what I call his soul place. So he runs away from home at age 17, and the ship lands in New York. He's looking for work there as a printer, can't find any. And I'm thinking, thank God, because New York was not the place to be in 1724. Philadelphia was. That was the city in the colonies. And someone says, Ben, you got to go to Philly. And he does. And he was a perfect match for the city at the time. It was a kind of wide open place where people didn't ask where you came from. They asked, what can you do? And that was the question that Ben Franklin wanted to answer.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. In our remaining time with Eric Weiner, his book is Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Now, Hal in Monroe asked, why didn't he become president? Well, Ben was older than George Washington. Yeah. He died in 1790, which I believe was a year Washington was elected. Back then, the elections were in a different cycle, but I believe elected in 89, took office in 90. But anyway, Ben Franklin was 84 years old.
84,
when
yeah.
He died.
The short answer is he was too old to be president. He was a good generation or two older than the other founders. In fact, at the Constitutional Convention, where he played a role in 1787, he was old enough to be the grandfather of most of the other men there. So I believe Washington was inaugurated in 91. And so Ben died in 1790 at the age of 84. So he did live a long life, but not long enough to become president, which is kind of a shame because I think he would have made an excellent president. And we could use someone like him today, to be honest.
Well, he was not disqualified, as was Alexander Hamilton, who was not born in the United States. But they're the two on U.S. currency of note who did not be, they were not presidents. But you say, now put it in perspective, he was born in 1706, and men in those days died in their 30s and 40s regularly. He was 70 years old when 1776 rolled around. Why was he so instrumental in the foundation of our country and formation?
Well, one thing is that he had this ability to change his mind. So he was late to the game, and that he's living in London and he's trying to fix things with the British Empire, with the king. He did not want to see the divorce, but at age 69, he realized that it was irrevocable. And so he became a rebel at age 69. And think about that. How many people make such a dramatic change in their life at a late age? So he brought a wisdom and a worldliness to the foundation of the country, and at the same time, a kind of earthiness. You know, he was a working class guy. He made his living as a printer at first, had 2 years of formal education, so he's self-taught. So he was this odd and wonderful combination of the sort of most down-to-earth of the founders and also the most cosmopolitan and international, and he was one of a kind in that way.
We not only knew English, as we know, but French, Italian, Spanish, Latin, which is a
German.
Yeah. He was a brilliant man, and he ranks with the great intellectuals in the history of this country. A listener asked about his religious affiliation. He was listed as a deist. Was he a spiritual man?
He was not conventionally religious. He was no fan of most of the clergy. I say most, but he was good friends with George Whitefield, who led the Great Awakening of the day. For him, religion was at its best when it was useful, when the church motivated people to get things done, to improve people's lives. So he was not an atheist, as some say. But he was not a devout churchgoer either. He believed in religion as usefulness. And toward the end of his life, he was asked by a reverend who was also president of Yale at the time, well, Ben, what do you think there's an afterlife? And he wrote a typically coy letter saying, well, I think I'm going to, you know, find out about it sooner anyway, and I don't need to answer your question. That was his big thing, is learning through experience. He was, as much as he loved books, he thought direct experience was how we learn the lessons that really stick with us.
You have a chapter, we're short, but it's Buddha Ben, which kind of relates to what we're talking about.
Yeah, and this is me, I would say taking some liberties, because Ben Franklin, I would say interpreting Ben, because Franklin didn't really know about Buddhism. He knew about China and Confucianism. But the more I looked at his life, it sort of fits what the Buddhists call a bodhisattva, which is someone who's achieved enlightenment, but instead of going off to nirvana, sticks around and helps people hear on themselves. And that's what he was like. He was going to stick around and be helpful as long as...
We do have to roll, but thank you so much. The book is Ben and Me from Eric Weiner. We're back tomorrow. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.